You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 5th of February 2018 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Tuck. On today's show, are relations between North and South Korea beginning to thaw? The former will send its most senior politician, no, not that one, to the Winter Olympics this month. My guests, Mary Jedewski and John Everard, will be discussing the latest from the peninsula and the day's other top stories, including...
Without the customs union and outside the single market, barriers to trade on goods and services are unavoidable. Time has come to make choice.
The EU's chief Brexit negotiator, Michel Barnier, has news for the UK. It can enjoy all the trade perks it's currently seeking in the trade bloc it's currently in. Yes, the EU. We'll also discuss whether Vladimir Putin's stern veneer houses a secret cuddly hugger within, and find out why London has a really big problem with cyclists. Yes, that's all to come on Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Mary Jedewski, columnist for The Independent and The Guardian, and John Everard, formerly British ambassador to Belarus, Uruguay and North Korea. Welcome both to the programme. And we're going to begin in the Korean Peninsula. The North will soon send the head of its parliament, Kim Jong-nam, to attend the Winter Olympics beginning this week. He's the highest level politician to have visited South Korea in years. So is it a genuine sign that relations are thawing between the two states? Now, John, you've actually met him.
I have indeed. Kim Jong-nam acts effectively as the Eternal President's representative on Earth. And yes, I've met him because he is formerly the head of state in North Korea. And so it's to him that ambassadors present their credentials. So I've met him, I sat and chatted to him. He's a pleasant man. He's not a youngster. He's 90 now. He wasn't that young when I met him either. But clearly his marbles are all intact. Knows a great deal about the world. Keeps himself well informed. Was a former foreign minister in days of yore, and his job is essentially to wander around being nice to foreigners. So he'll feel quite at home, I think, in Pyeongchang.
And he's managed, unlike many leading politicians, to survive the changing of the leadership, which in the past we've seen many people kind of taken out in one way or the other from the administration as a new head has come in.
Yes, but I think that is largely because by the time Kim Il-sung had died, he was already a kind of symbolic father figure, and nobody thought it was worth moving Kim Jong-nam. He didn't have any real power or anything. He was just a figurehead, and he wasn't actually subject to the kind of political pressures that people who actually had to make decisions were subject to.
But just tell us before we bring Mary in, what should we read into the decision to send him?
I think this is another example of North Korea laying it on really, really thick. They know that President Moon of South Korea is desperate almost to have a very high-level North Korean representation at the Games because that makes it look good. It looks like advance towards reunification of the peninsula and so on. But of course, as the North Korean media have pointed out repeatedly, what is given can also be taken away. And North Korea has asked in exchange for all this largesse that firstly there be no further exercises between the United States and South Korea, and even that the United States forces in South Korea be withdrawn. Now, I have this sinking feeling that as the opening ceremony of the Games approaches, on the 9th of February, of course, that North Korea's demands will become more and more strident, and we may have a situation where when South Korea says, no, we can't give you these things, the North throws a tantrum and Kim Jong-nam doesn't, after all, go.
Now, Mary, you know the ruminations from another part of the world, from DC, very well. And when we look at the policy of the US administration, they seem to, if we're generous, have had an approach of let's play a double game. Let's let President Moon do the nicey-nicey stuff and say, come and play with me. And we'll be the ones who say, we're not going to put up with your rhetoric and we'll come and thump you if you carry on. it seems to be working.
Well, exactly. That was something that I was going to say. I mean, we've had Donald Trump and various people in his entourage saying the most extraordinary things that you would never expect, even the United States in its huge position of power, to be saying to another country, even such a country as ostensibly weak as North Korea. Completely undiplomatic language. And yet, some of that, at least, you could argue, has actually had a positive effect, that it's pushed North Korea towards the situation that it's in now, with a sort of on the verge of a rapprochement with the South that we haven't seen for a number of years. So I think if you were sitting in Washington, you could argue that diplomacy, though it's hardly worthy of the word diplomacy, has had an effect. But of course, what John said in a way puts me in my place, because while I am hugely optimistic at reading the signals, looking at the positive aspects that were in Kim Jong-un's New Year address, where everybody concentrated on all the aggressive noises, and nobody, especially in the United States, seemed to take seriously the little olive branches that were pushed in between. You know, now I feel slightly vindicated to that extent. But of course, as John says, what's happened now is that the North has got themselves into a very strong position where the South actually has something to lose when its great Olympic show begins. And if North Korea is saying, well, actually, we might have second thoughts about this if you don't give us X and Y. So, you know, it's not all over yet.
Yes, worth remembering, too, that only yesterday North Korea was supposed to be performing jointly with the South in a grand cultural event. The North Koreans threw a tantrum over that and withdrew. It didn't go ahead.
But what I don't get is, you know, why does it matter to the South Koreans? You know, the South Koreans have, you know, they're staging the event. They've got all the venues. They can cope without North Korean athletes turning up. Why do they care in the end whether the North Koreans, you know, are there on the ice rink or coming down the hill on their skis? Surely they're going to be look the more organised country of the two.
Well, yes. I mean, being more organised than North Korea is frankly not an exacting standard, but sure. I don't think we're here talking about South Koreans as a whole. It's fairly clear from opinion polls in South Korea that the South Korean government's move towards North Korea on this doesn't enjoy widespread support. And throwing good, hard-working, you know, carefully trained South Korean ice hockey players off the team to make room for North Koreans really went down very badly indeed. I don't think this is South Koreans in general. I think this is President Moon Jae-in in particular. Remember, his family come from the North. The whole thing about North Korea, rapprochement, bringing the two Koreas together, really tugs at his heartstrings. And it does look to me as if he's got rather far ahead of his own public opinion.
And do we understand why they want to march behind this single flag? Because when you hear it in Europe, you filter these events through things such as, for like the two Germanys. And you can't imagine two Germanys, the East saying, oh, I know, we'll come and march with the West Germans all those years ago. It seems strange that they want this kind of unified front suddenly now.
Well, I think that's true on the one hand. On the other hand, I think an aspect of what John was talking about, there is a sense, especially probably in South Korea, as there might have been in West Germany in its day, as there might have been in Cyprus now, there is a sort of a sentiment in divided countries that sees unity, however symbolic, however empty, as being something that's really desirable. And I think if you're hosting this sort of event, like the Winter Olympics, then you see a virtue in a gesture that presents you, in this case, South Korea, as being both magnanimous but also able somehow to accommodate what is still, you know, the other half of the same country.
Yes, I think that's right. Two other points on the same issue. Firstly, these are Koreans, not Germans. And the symbolism of flags in Korean culture is much more important than it is in Europe. So marching on the same flag is really a big thing. Secondly, this won't be the first time that they've done it, if indeed this goes ahead. As I said, give you champagne and ice for the time being. They did it in one of the previous Olympics. I think it was 2002, I might be wrong. And part of the symbol symbolism is. President Moon Jae-in showing that he can bring inter-Korean relations back to the level they were before everything started to go wrong.
I think there's something else too, that although you can't imagine the same thing happening between divided Germany, just think back to how quickly German reunification happened, how little opposition there was in either country, which had been separated and under completely different systems for so many years, how ready West Germany was to pay extra taxes to revive the hugely neglected East. And they're still paying, to an extent, an extra premium to rebuild the eastern part of Germany. And that's had really, until quite recently, very little opposition. There is still that huge sentiment there.
Yes, whereas in Korea, people already complain about the prospect of paying extra taxes. No enthusiasm at all. Interestingly, also, as in Germany, in North Korea, enthusiasm for unification is almost universal. You can talk to any North Korean and they love the idea. But most South Koreans you talk to get very iffy about it. Why should we pay for all this? They say, reunification, yes, of course, national destiny, but not in my lifetime.
But John, just before we move on, North Koreans like it because they think they'll take over the South, or their attitudes will, or do they think that they like the idea of unification because everywhere will be like South Korea?
More the latter. They watch South Korean soap operas and perhaps don't convey an accurate picture of South Korean life, but it's the only insight that North Koreans get. And they want a piece of the action. They want to be beautiful like all the heroines there. They want the smart cars, the nice restaurants and the clean apartments.
Well, we're going to take one other story from south of the border now, because the Samsung Air J.Y. Lee has just had his five-year prison sentence suspended and has left jail after just 1 year. Lee was convicted of bribing the country's former president, which led to protests over corruption in the nation. Mary, what do we make of this? So it's interesting, the Chaebols, these huge, powerful industrial conglomerates in Korea, and it's always been accused or said that they kind of like pull all the political purse strings. And here we saw it in action. He was accused of giving over $8 million to the president, who is also being now charged with corruption and tried. But what does this say about the power, do you think, of those business units today?
Well, I suppose that my surprise is less that he was released so soon than that he was actually convicted and imprisoned at all. So, you know, for somebody so prominent, part of such a gigantic and global company, to be found guilty and to be put in jail, to me, that was, if you like, out of the ordinary, rather than the fact that he's been released. I know the reports that, well, you know, he was only sort of in a rather sham way in jail, that he was being able to run pretty much everything he wanted to run from inside prison. So it wasn't a huge deprivation. But of course, if you're on the outside looking in and you're an ordinary South Korean, hoping that one day maybe either the power of the Chaebols or the sleaze element in South Korea might be diminished, you'd be hugely disappointed by this.
John, yeah, the same question, because we've had Park Geun-hye, is her trial is coming up. President Moon has done a great job at kind of asserting a kind of cleaner way of doing business. Is this back to the old ways?
No, not necessarily. I think it's too early to say exactly what has happened. But it's important to note, firstly, that he has not been absolved. What has happened is that his sentence has been turned into a suspended sentence. Nobody has suggested that the original, that the core verdict be overturned. The reason that it was reduced was that a number of the subsidiary charges have been dismissed by the appeals court. Now, it's possible that here we're seeing an example. Mary's raising her eyebrows. Here we're seeing an example of Samsung's considerable political clout being borne to bear. It's also possible, simply, that he was innocent, that some of the charges were misapplied. I think we need to know a lot more about those charges and about why the appeal court came to a decision before offering an opinion.
Well, we're going to move to Europe now, where Michel Barnier, the EU's chief negotiator on Brexit, was in London today. After meetings with Theresa May and the Brexit Secretary David Davis, Barnier has said that the UK will face unavoidable barriers in its future trade relations with the bloc if it pursues leaving the customs union. Mary,
Politicians on the right, the Brexit politicians, don't give a damn. They put up all the barriers you want. They say we're going to run off into the sunset and make deals with other people. In a way, Michel Barnier misses the point that the argument here in the UK has moved so far to the right of the Tory party, with people like Rees-Mogg, you know, demanding a storm away from the European Union. They don't care what the European Union does. They just want us out.
Yes, I mean, that's entirely true. And we've spent the last week in the UK really having what seems like a sort of an open argument within the government, not between the government and the opposition, but within the government about what sort of trade relationship the UK should have with the European Union after the divorce. And on, I think, Sunday morning or even Sunday night, Downing Street came out with a statement saying no customs union, which was the point at issue. And of course, if there is no customs union, then there is no formal trade relationship other than that there will actually be trade barriers and tariffs between the UK and the European Union. And the reason the customs union concept was in play in the first place was largely because of the question of the Irish border, because the customs union, as opposed to the single market, being a slight distinction between them, would be the sort of minimal requirement for there to be a soft border, tariff-free border between Northern Ireland and the Irish Republic. And so far as I can see, by throwing that out at this stage in procedures, they're going to have to accept that there will be a trade, a hard border between Northern Ireland and the South. And I don't think that even now the hardline Brexiteers have actually figured that out, or that what they sort of airy-fairily call technological solutions will somehow make that any different.
Well, I don't think they care if they're ultimately a hard border. The people on the far right of the party, they pretend they are, but they're a bit indifferent to it. John, we're still in like the have cake and eat it phase, aren't we?
Well, yes, there's a bit of that. Do you know, reading all this stuff, it leaves me thinking that although I can't penetrate the mind of Theresa May, but if I were a dedicated Remainer, well, actually, I am a dedicated Remainer, but you know, if I were Prime Minister in that position and I wanted to prevent Brexit ever happening while at the same time preventing the right wing of my party from jumping down my throat, I think I'd do pretty much what she's doing now. You put out, just from time to time, you throw red meat to the wolves, putting out completely indefensible positions. Of course we can't leave the customs union. I mean, come on, can we get real about this? And it's the Irish border, you're quite right, Mary, and a host of other reasons too. And you know that if you say these things, you just have to sort of count to 10, and the entire business lobby bursts through your door saying, what on earth are you playing at? And you're pushed back. I think the key element in all this toing and froing is the remark by old Barney, Michel Barnier, to give him his full title, that we are running out of time. No time to lose, he said. We have to accelerate the contacts. If we don't get our act together really very, very quickly, we are not going to be able to reach any kind of deal but before the deadline. It is probably already too late, in fact, and the more the Conservative Party spends time fighting amongst itself rather than negotiating, the more a motor deal comes. So that, come March next year, you're faced with the choice between actually walking out without a deal, which would be economic suicide, and simply rescinding Article 50, which is going to be.
Well, you may have heard it here first. Theresa May actually may have a plan. We'll see. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Tuck, John Everard and Mary Jajewski. Coming up next, Putin reveals he's a hugger. And we'll also ask why politicians' body language says about them.
The First Monocle of 2018 is a media special, which takes us into the parallel worlds of music, movies, TV, technology and, of course, print. We sit down with Takeshi Idezawa, the CEO of Japanese messaging app LINE, and get to know the cast of oddball characters who have helped him and his company conquer Asia. We head to LA for an expo that goes behind the scenes at the studios producing that most enduring and best-loved format in American television, the game show. From The Price is Right to Wheel of Fortune, we discover what lies behind the undying popularity of such programs. Then it's off to Indonesia to meet the team that publishes Compass, the leading Catholic-owned newspaper in a country where over 85% of the population is Muslim. And finally, in the design section, we take a tour around the former Berlin Broadcasting House that's been converted into a slick new arts hub. The Monocle February issue is out now. Get your media fix and pick up your copy today, or subscribe at monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House, and still with me are Mary Jadevsky and John Everard. Now, notoriously poker-faced Russian leader Vladimir Putin has been making headlines recently for an unusual reason. On a recent trip to a factory in the Russian city of Ufa, rather than answering one question from the factory floor, the Russian strongman simply answered a worker, "Let me just give you a hug." And he proceeded to do so. The worker in question has now become something of a minor celebrity, such as the rarity of an event like this. Mary, let's start with you. Do you think he had a drink before? I don't think he drinks that much, does he? What was going on here?
Well, I mean, it's very hard to divine because, as you say, Putin is rather stony-faced, undemonstrative, unemotional, at least on the surface. But, you know, election campaigns do funny things to people. It's obviously not Putin's first election campaign, but I think he has been seen not exactly hugging babies, but there was a very peculiar occasion where he picked up some child and kissed his tummy button.
There were
pictures all over the place, and everybody was trying to divine whether this was some old Russian practice or whether Putin had some sort of very suspect proclivities. It was all very embarrassing. So at least, you know, hugging a factory worker, and not just any factory worker, but interestingly, a factory worker who asked why the sort of Soviet-style awards for things like best worker and best factory, why those things disappeared. And you can sort of see that Putin, who also, you know, who would have grown up through those years as well, that maybe he had some sort of fellow feeling for it, and that this was just a little bit more than electioneering.
John, in general, should politicians be hugging people, or?
I think the health implications are really quite worrying, don't you? I mean, where's it going to end? Okay, so Putin hugs a worker. Are we going to see Theresa May hugging people who give her difficult questions? She'll do a lot of hugging if she does that.
Well, I think we've had enough. We might have a little group hug at the end of the show, but we're going to move on to the final story of the day, because I know that both of our guests, normally we would kind of like give the last story 2 minutes, but I've got a feeling this is where we may see less hugging and more kind of punches thrown at in the next few minutes, because the UK's House of Lords has been criticised for helping propagate myths about bicycle lanes in highly congested London. Peers, such as the scientist Professor Robert Winston, have been highlighted by cycling campaigners as having used evidence-free, anecdotal arguments in the UK's upper chamber, referring to cycle lanes as causing congestion and worsening pollution. So where do those views come from? Well, John, you arrive here regularly in your helmet. Yes. And with a bicycle as well, I might point out, but on a bicycle with a helmet too. So I take it you're a keen cyclist. Do you think you're a problem for our city, or do you think you're a thing of good?
Oh, I don't think I call myself a thing of good in any sense. Am I a problem for the city? Probably, but not because I ride a bicycle. I mean, London, like so many other big cities, teeters on the brink of gridlock. There's simply too much traffic around, not enough space, and the only way you can cope with this is either by persuading people to ride bicycles, which takes up a lot less road space than a motor vehicle, or by spending very large amounts of money in infrastructure. I mean, things like the Elizabeth line that's about to be completed is an example of that. It works, but it is hideously expensive. And we're seeing the message get round. The number of cyclists is increasing almost exponentially in London. The cycle lanes, which are largely put in by the previous mayor, are filling rapidly. I keep finding myself now in cycle traffic jams in them. And more people are simply abandoning their cars and getting on their bicycles, which can only be a good thing.
Mary, you're not so sure. You don't arrive. I haven't seen you yet in kind of like in a cagoule and a big old helmet.
No, I mean, my lycra is non-existent, I have to say. I arrive by bus. So I'm being very socially responsible in using public transport. I regret to say, as someone who lives in central London, I do also have a car. But the reason I have a car is because my husband found it very difficult to walk, had Parkinson's disease, and using a car was almost the only way that he could get from A to B. And cycle lanes have been catastrophic from that point of view. They've occupied huge amounts of road space. They've taken out the possibility to drop somebody off, because then you end up blocking the whole traffic. And the time that it... I agree with the Lords. I mean, they should have been there with their stopwatches and had some sort of scientific analysis. But I would reckon, and this is totally anecdotal, that it now takes me at least 30% longer to get from central London to the Midori House studio. To cross Parliament Square can take 20 minutes because all the traffic is converging, and every lane, there used to be two lanes in each direction converging on Parliament Square. Now from two directions, there's only one lane. And the cyclists who have their own lane, if the red light is against them, they simply hop out of their own lane and into the car lane and block the car lane.
Now, John, what's interesting, I'm someone who might do public transport, might occasionally do a car, and certainly does a bicycle. But the thing I don't like about cyclists, and these are my fellow cyclists, is, you know, they do swarm or kind of over everywhere. They certainly jump most lights. Many people still don't have a light on their bicycle. And I think this is what makes the sense of friction with all the people who are in cars, and also on buses and in taxis. It feels that there is always a confrontation about, you know, like a minute away. There's aggression in both lanes.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you see examples of bad cycling just as you see examples of bad driving. You know, just because people ride bicycles doesn't always mean that they're responsible road users, sadly. I have to say, I recognise what you're saying. It seems to me, and I've been cycling around the city now for 20 years or so, maybe more, that it's become a lot less, that cycling is settling down, it's becoming mainstream. Though not so long ago, cycling in London was heavily influenced by the cycle courier culture. The city couriers who carry important documents around on bicycles, as a badge of honour, would always jump red lights. And if there was a rule they could find to break, they'd break it just because it was there to break. There was a lot of that around. I think there's a lot less of that. And I noticed that when cyclists crash lights at junctions, they get a lot of bad looks and often catcalls from other cyclists. You know, there's a lot of peer pressure being brought to bear now.
Well, I hope
not enough.
I'm going to say,
well, or on drivers too. I mean, if we're talking about bad road behaviour, that one of the big problems that we face is drivers who simply ignore the lines for cycle lanes and who occupy bicycle boxes. I know you wouldn't dream of it, Mary.
Of course I wouldn't dream of it. And good. I actually support cycle lanes in principle. I think that the idea of separating motorised transport from cycles is absolutely necessary, because it was hugely dangerous before. But the problem is that it's hugely dangerous and extra polluting and slowing everything down now, simply because of the way that these cycle lanes have been put in place.
You were talking earlier about the Lords not having stood there with stopwatches. London seems to be full of people who do just that. I mean, we're awash with statistics, all of which show that, yes, traffic is slowing in the city, but it's not because of the cycle lanes. There's only 12 miles of segregated cycle lane in the entire city, Mary.
Should we maybe finish the show, or should I go and put the kettle on, or make some tea for everyone?
I knew
once we got this started, there would be no need for a host. We're going to wrap the show up, because I think these two are going to continue their very interesting debate, because that is the end of the show. John Everard and Mary Jezewski, thank you very much for joining us here at Midori House. The show was produced by Tom Hall. I don't think I've seen him on a bicycle. It was researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. He'd definitely not get on a bicycle in his clothes. And also by Louis Hartnett, Omara even. Our studio manager, David Stevens. I'm not sure. I've seen many pictures, but never on a bicycle. More music next, then 1900 Hours, It's Culture with Mr. Robert Bound, and we'll have more of the day's main news stories at 2200 Hours. But from me, Ad Chuck, thank you and goodbye.